program you're about to hear involves slack confidence, is parody, satire, and comedy. Any reference to Bob, the church of subgenius, religion, politics, or any other touchy subjects is intended only as humor and to cast no reflection on the high standards of WREK Atlanta, its staff, or that of Georgia Tech.
There are certain things that are happening, certain things that are taking place that we know of in this world that make us realize that it cannot go on much longer as it is.
Hey, nothing means nothing, man. You know that. Look around, the whole planet's in total chaos.
The day of reckoning is upon us.
You gotta get what you can, while you can, because some pure curtain can put a 22 in the back of your head any second.
There are certain portions of the church that somehow wants to go through the Great Tribulation period. If that's your desire, ask the Lord for it.
You look a little shaken up.
Oh, no. I'm just a little worried about my future. I'm a little upset about my future.
Welcome to the new millennium, my friend.
As we look about us today, there cannot help but be a throbbing knowledge in the hearts and lives of every Christian that Jesus is soon to come. It's not a specific sign, but yet you could say that it is, and it's this. I will pour out of my spirit upon all flesh.
Ew. Oh, not again, Jimmy. I ain't cleaning up after that.
Listen, my sister, please. They moaned for 30 minutes.
Well, in that case, I'll get back to you in the future.
The past was dead. The future was unimaginable.
Oh, yeah? Well, I can imagine it. I don't have a whole lot of green power. Oh, and I've got lots of help helping us out tonight, Seekers. I've got Jeff Love and his orchestra. I've got the South Soul Orchestra. We're going to have the Star Spangled Washboard Band and Percy Faith and the Dr. X Band and the Realistic Sound Odyssey and Paul Corino at the Organ Grinder Organ and the Living Strings and Diodato and the Cambridge Buskers and the Stereo Sound Orchestra and the J.J. Daniel High School Band and Roger Williams and Terry Baxter. Executives and Lenny D and Ferranti and Teicher and Stan Kenton and Ray Conniff and the Spurlow Band and the Scottsboro High School Band and the Lymph Node Institute and Ray McVay and his orchestra and the Portsmouth Symphonia. And we're even gonna have something from a porno movie tonight, Seekers, because I want to let you know what is in store for you for the future. Oh, you can expect a lot, Seekers. A lot more of the same.
From his book, tonight, Seekers, our special guest, Arthur C. Clarke.
Call it the Stargate. For 3 million years, it had circled Saturn, waiting for a moment of destiny that might never come. In its making, the moon had been shattered, and the debris of its creation orbited still. Now the long wait was ending. On yet another world, intelligence had been born and was escaping from its planetary cradle. An ancient experiment was about to reach its climax. Those who had begun that experiment so long ago had not been men or even remotely human. But they were flesh and blood, and when they looked out across the deeps of space, they had felt awe and wonder and loneliness. As soon as they possessed the power, they set forth for the stars. In their explorations, they encountered life in many forms and watched the workings of evolution on a thousand worlds. They saw how often the first faint sparks of intelligence flickered and died in the cosmic night. And because in all the galaxy, they had found nothing more precious than mind, they encouraged it dawning everywhere. They became farmers in the fields of stars. They sowed, and sometimes they reaped. And sometimes, dispassionately, they had to weed. Another visit would serve little purpose. It was one of a million silent worlds, few of which would ever speak. And now, out among the stars, evolution was driving towards new goals. The first explorers of Earth had long since come to the limits of flesh and blood. As soon as their machines were better than their bodies, it was time to move. First their brains, and then their thoughts alone, they transferred into shining new homes of metal and of plastic. Among the stars. They no longer built spaceships. They were spaceships. But the age of the machine entities swiftly passed. In their ceaseless experimenting, they had learned to store knowledge in the structure of space itself and to preserve their thoughts for eternity in frozen lattices of light. They could become creatures of radiation, free at last from the tyranny of matter. Into pure energy, therefore, they pleasantly transformed themselves. And on a thousand worlds, the empty shells they had discarded twitched for a while in a mindless dance of death, then crumbled into rust. Now they were lords of the galaxy, and beyond the reach of time. They could rove at will among the stars, and sink like a subtle mist through the very interstices of space. But despite their godlike powers, they had not wholly forgotten their origin in the warm slime of a vanished sea. And they still watched over the experiments their ancestors had started so long ago. The air in the ship is getting quite foul, and I have a headache most of the time. There's still plenty of oxygen, but the purifiers never really cleaned up all the messes after the liquids aboard started boiling into vacuum. When things get too bad, I go down to the garage and bleed off some pure oxygen from the pods. There's been no reaction to any of my signals, and because of my orbital inclination, I'm getting slowly further and further away from TMA-2. Incidentally, the name you've given it is doubly inappropriate. There's still no trace of a magnetic field. At the moment, my closest approach is 60 miles. It will increase to about 100 as the apparatus rotates beneath me, then drop back to zero. I'll pass directly over the thing in 30 days, but that's too long to wait, and then it will be in darkness anyway. Even now, it's only in sight for a few minutes before it falls below the horizon again. It's damn frustrating. I can't make any serious observations. So I'd like your approval of this plan. The space pods have ample delta V for a touchdown and a return to the ship. I want to go extra vehicle and make a close survey of the object. If it appears safe, I'll land beside it, or even on top of it. The ship will still be above my horizon while I'm going down, so I won't be out of touch for more than 90 minutes. I'm convinced that this is the only thing to do. I've come a billion miles. I don't want to be stopped by the last 60. For weeks, as it stared forever sunward with its strange senses, the Stargate had watched the approaching ship. Its makers had prepared it for many things, and this was one of them. It recognized what was climbing up towards it in the warm heart of the solar system. If it had been alive, it would have felt excitement, but such an emotion is wholly beyond its powers. Even if the ship had passed it by, it would not have known the slightest trace of disappointment. It had waited 3 million years. It was prepared to wait for eternity. It observed and noted and took no action as the visitor checked its speed with jets of incandescent gas. Presently, it felt the gentle touch of radiations trying to probe its secrets, and still it did nothing. Now the ship was in orbit, circling low above the surface of this strangely piebald moon. It began to speak with blasts of radio waves, counting out the prime numbers from 1 to 11 over and over again. Soon these gave way to more complex signals at many frequencies, ultraviolet, infrared, X-rays. The Stargate made no reply. It had nothing to say. There was a long pause then before it observed that something was falling down towards it from the orbiting ship. It searched its memories, and the logic circuits made their decisions, according to the orders given them long ago. Beneath the cold light of Saturn, the Stargate awakened its slumbering powers. Discovery looked just as he had last seen her from space, floating in lunar orbit with the moon taking up half the sky. Perhaps there was one slight change. He could not be sure, but some of the paint of her external lettering announcing the purpose of various hatches, connections, umbilical plugs, and other attachments that have faded during its long exposure to the unshielded sun. altitude was still about 5 miles. He was heading straight towards the huge dark mass that soared in such geometrical perfection above a featureless plain. It was as blank as a flat, white surface beneath. Until now, he had not appreciated how enormous it really was. There were very few single buildings on Earth as large as this. His carefully measured photographs indicated a height of almost 2,000 feet. And as far as could be judged, its proportions were precisely the same as TNA-1's. A curious ratio 1:4:9. I'm only 3 miles away now, holding altitude at 4,000 feet. Still not a sign of activity, nothing on any of the instruments. The faces seem absolutely smooth and polished. Surely you'd expect some meteorite damage after all this time. And there's no debris on the, well, I suppose you could call it the roof. No sign of an opening either. I've been hoping there might be some way in. Now I'm right above it, hovering 500 feet up. I don't want to waste any time, since discovery will soon be out of range. I'm going to land. It's certainly solid enough. And if it isn't, I'll blast off at once. Just a minute. That's odd. Bowman's voice died into the silence of utter bewilderment. He was not alarmed. He literally could not describe what he was seeing. He had been hanging above a large, flat rectangle, 800 feet long and 200 wide, made of something that looked as solid as rock. But now it seemed to be receding from him. It was exactly like one of those optical illusions, when a three-dimensional object can, by an effort of will, appear to turn inside out, its near and far sides suddenly interchanging. That was happening to this huge, apparently solid structure. Impossibly, incredibly, it was no longer a monolith, rearing high above a flat plain. What had seemed to be its roof had dropped away to infinite depths. For one dizzy moment, we seemed to be looking down a vertical shaft, a rectangular duct, which defied the laws of perspective, where its size did not decrease with distance. The eye of Iapetus had blinked, as if to remove an irritating speck of dust. David Bowman had time for just one broken sentence. It's awaiting men in mission control, 900 million miles away, and 80 minutes in the future, we're never to forget. The thing's hollow. It goes on forever, and, oh my God, it's full of stars. The stargate opened. The stargate closed. In a moment of time too short to be measured, space turned and twisted upon itself. Then Iapetus was once more alone, as it had been for 3 million years.
Come on, Danny.
Alone, except for a deserted but not yet derelict ship, sending back to its makers messages which they could neither believe nor understand.
On 8-track.
Too late that he had paid more attention to those theories of hyperspace or transdimensional ducts. To David Bowman, they were theories no longer. Perhaps that monolith on Iapetus was hollow. Perhaps the roof was only an illusion, or some kind of diaphragm that had opened to let him through. But into what? As far as he could trust his senses, he appeared to be dropping vertically down a huge rectangular shaft, several thousand feet deep. He was moving faster and faster, but the far end never changed its size and remained always at the same distance from him. Only the stars moved, at first so slowly that it was some time before he realized that they were escaping out of the frame that held them. But in a little while, it was obvious that the star field was expanding, as if it was rushing towards him at an inconceivable speed. The expansion was non-linear. The stars at the center hardly seemed to move, but those towards the edge accelerated more and more swiftly until they became streaks of light just before they vanished from view. There were always others to replace them, flowing into the center of the field from an apparently inexhaustible source. Roman would wonder what would happen if a star came straight towards him. Would it continue to expand until he plunged directly into the face of a sun? But not one came near enough to show a disk. Eventually, they all veered aside and streaked over the edge of their rectangular frame. And still the far end of the shaft came no closer. It was almost as if the walls were moving with him, carrying him to his unknown destination. Or perhaps he was really motionless, and space was moving past him. Not only space, he suddenly realized, was involved in whatever was happening to him now. The clock on the pod's small instrument panel was also behaving strangely. Normally, the numbers in the tenth of a second window flickered past so quickly it was almost impossible to read them. Now they were appearing and disappearing at discrete intervals, and he could count them off one by one without difficulty. The seconds themselves were passing with incredible slowness, as if time itself were coming to a stop. At last, the tenth of a second counter froze between 5 and 6. Yet he could still think and even observe as the ebon walls flowed past at the speed that might have been anything between 0 and 1,000,000 times the velocity of light. Somehow, he was not in the least surprised, nor was he alarmed. On the contrary, he felt a sense of calm expectation, such as he had once known when the space medics had tested him with hallucinogenic drugs. The world around him was strange and wonderful, but there was nothing to fear. He had traveled these millions of miles in search of mystery, and now it seemed the mystery was coming to him. The rectangle ahead was growing lighter. The luminous star streaks were paling against a milky sky, whose brilliance increased moment by moment. It seemed as if the space pod was heading towards a bank of cloud, uniformly illuminated by the rays of an invisible sun. He was emerging from the tunnel. The far end, which until now had remained at that same indeterminate distance, neither approaching nor receding, had suddenly started to obey the normal laws of perspective. It was coming closer and steadily widening before him. At the same time, he felt that he was moving upward, and for a fleeting instant, he wondered if he had fallen right through the apertus that was now ascending from the other side. Even before the space pod soared out into the open, he knew that this place had nothing to do with the apertus, or with any world within the experience of man. There was no atmosphere, and he could see all details unblurred, clear down to an incredibly remote and flat horizon. He must be above a world of enormous size, perhaps one much larger than Earth. Yet despite its extent, all the surface that Roman could see was tessellated into obviously artificial patterns that must have been miles on a side. It was like the jigsaw puzzle of a giant that played with planets, and at the centers of many of those squares and triangles and polygons were gaping black shafts, twins of the chasm from which he had just emerged. We'll be right back. more disturbing than even the improbable land beneath. For there were no stars, neither was there the blackness of space. It was only a softly glowing milkiness that gave the impression of infinite distance. Roman remembered the description he had once heard of the dreaded Antarctic whiteout, like being inside a ping-pong ball. Those words could be applied perfectly to this weird place, but the explanation must be utterly different. This sky could be no meteorological effect of mist and snow. There was a perfect vacuum here. Then, as Bowman's eyes grew accustomed to the nacreous glow that filled the heavens, he became aware of another detail. The sky was not, as he had thought at first glance, completely empty. Dotted overhead, quite motionless, and forming apparently random patterns, were myriads of tiny black specks. They were difficult to see. They were mere points of darkness. But once detected, they were quite unmistakable. They reminded Bowman of something. Something so familiar, yet so insane, that he refused to accept the parallel until logic forced it upon him. Those black holes in the white sky were stars. He might have been looking at a photographic negative of the Milky Way. Where in God's name am I? Bowman asked himself. And even as he posed the question, he felt certain that he could never know the answer. It seemed that space had been turned inside out. This was not a place for man. Though the capsule was comfortably warm, he felt suddenly cold and was afflicted by an almost uncontrollable trembling. He wanted to close his eyes and shut out the pearly nothingness that surrounded him, but that was the act of a coward, and he would not yield to it. The pierced and faceted planet slowly rolled beneath him without any real change of scenery. He guessed he was about 10 miles above the surface and should be able to see any signs of life at ease. But this whole world was deserted. Intelligence had come here, worked its will upon it, and gone its way again. Then he noticed, humped above the flat plain, perhaps 20 miles away, a roughly cylindrical pile of debris that could only be the carcass of a gigantic ship. It was too distant for him to see any details, and it passed out of sight within a few seconds, but he could make out broken ribs and dully gleaming sheets of metal that had been partly peeled off, like the skin of an orange. He wondered how many thousands of years the wreck had lain here on its deserted checkerboard, and what manner of creatures had sailed it between the stars.
Country Club has the pleasure of presenting the group voted number one in the nation for polka music.
Then he forgot the derelict, for something was coming up over the horizon. At first, it looked like a flat disc, but that was because it was heading almost directly towards him. As it approached and passed beneath, he saw that it was spindle-shaped and several hundred feet long. Though there were faintly visible bands here and there along its length, it was hard to focus upon them. The object appeared to be vibrating, or perhaps spinning, at a very rapid rate. It tapered to a point at either end, and there was no sign of propulsion. Only one thing about it was familiar to human eyes, and that was its color. If it was indeed a solid artifact, and not an optical phantom, then its makers perhaps shared some of the emotions of men. They certainly did not share the limitations. The spindle appeared to be made of gold. Bowman moved his head to the rear view system to watch the thing drop behind. It had ignored him completely, and now he saw that it was falling out of the sky, down towards one of those thousands of great slots. A few seconds later it disappeared in a final flash of gold as it dived into the planet. He was alone again, beneath that sinister sky, and the sense of isolation and remoteness was more overwhelming than ever. Then he saw that he also was sinking down towards the mottled surface of the giant world, and that another of the rectangular chasms yawned immediately below. The empty sky closed above him, the clock crawled to rest, and once again his father's calling between infinite ebon walls towards another distant patch of stars. But now he was sure that he was not returning to the solar system, and in a flash of insight that might have been wholly spurious, he knew what this thing must surely be. It was some kind of cosmic switching device, routing the traffic of the stars through unimaginable dimensions of space and time. He was passing through a grand central station of the galaxy. Far ahead, the walls of the slot were becoming dimly visible once more, and the faint light diffusing downward from some still hidden source. And then the darkness was abruptly whipped away as the tiny space pod hurtled upward into a sky ablaze with stars. He was back in space as he knew it, but a single glance told him that he was light centuries from Earth. He did not even attempt to find any of the familiar constellations that since the beginning of history had been the friends of man. Perhaps none of the stars that now blazed around him had ever been seen by the unaided human eye. Most of them were concentrated in the glowing belt, broken here and there with dark bands of obscuring cosmic dust which completely circled the sky. It was like the Milky Way, but scores of times brighter. Roman wondered if this was indeed his own galaxy, seen from a point much closer to its brilliant, crowded center. He hoped that it was. Then he would not be so far from home. One that any telescope had ever glimpsed. He looked back to see the thing from which he was rising and had another shock. Here was no giant, multifaceted world, nor any duplicate of the Iapetus. There was nothing except an inky shadow against the stars, like a doorway opening from a darkened room into a still darker night. Even as he watched, that doorway closed. It did not recede from him. It slowly filled with stars, as if a rent in the fabric of space had been repaired. Then he was alone beneath the alien sky. The space pod was slowly turning, and as it did so, it brought fresh wonders into view. First, there was a perfectly spherical swarm of stars, becoming more and more closely packed towards the center, until its heart was a continuous glow of light. Its outer edges were ill-defined, a slowly thinning halo of sun that merged imperceptibly into the background of more distant stars. This glorious apparition, Bowman knew, was a globular cluster. He was looking upon something that no human eye had ever seen, save as a smudge of light in the field of a telescope. He could not remember the distance to the nearest known cluster. He was sure that there were none within 1,000 light years of the solar system. The pod continued its slow rotation to disclose an even stranger sight, a huge red sun, many times larger than the moon seen from Earth. Bowman could look straight into its face without discomfort. Judging by its color, it was no hotter than a glowing coal. Here and there, set into the somber red, were rivers of bright yellow, incandescent Amazons meandering for thousands of miles before they lost themselves in the deserts of this dying sun. Dying? No. That was a wholly false impression, born of human experience and the emotions aroused by the hues of sunset or the glow of fading embers. This was a star that had left behind the powdered extravagances of its youth. It raced through the violets and blues and greens of the spectrum in a few fleeting billions of years, and had now settled down to a peaceful maturity of unimaginable length. All that had gone before was not a thousandth of what was yet to come. The story of this star had barely begun.
Closer to the edge, and finally, right about the time the music changes and it goes that Space Odyssey thing, you know, it goes bum 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 bum, boom, you go out over the edge and the bottom falls out, and all of a sudden you're a mile off the ground and you're exposed to the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen in my life. You talk about breathtaking, it's incredible.
Lay straight ahead. Though there was no sense of motion, Bowman knew that he was still gripped by whatever controlling force brought him here from Saturn. All the science and engineering skill of Earth seemed hopelessly primitive now against the powers that were carrying him to some unimaginable fate. He stared into the sky ahead, trying to pick out the goal towards which he was being taken, perhaps some planet circling this great sun. There was nothing that showed any visible disk or exceptional brightness. If there are planets orbiting here, he could not distinguish them from the stellar background. Then he noticed that something strange was happening on the very edge of this sun's crimson disk. A white glow had appeared there and was rapidly waxing in brilliance. He wondered if he was seeing one of those sudden eruptions or flares that trouble most stars from time to time. The light became brighter and bluer, began to spread along the edge of the sun, whose blood-red hues paled swiftly by comparison. It was almost, Bowman told himself, smiling at the absurdity of the thought, as if you were watching sunrise on a sun. And so indeed he was. Above the burning horizon lifted something no larger than a star, but so brilliant that the eye could not bear to look upon it. A mere point of blue-white radiance, like an electric arc, was moving at unbelievable speed across the face of the great sun. It must be very close to its giant companion, for immediately below it, drawn upward by its gravitational pull, was a column of flame thousands of miles high. It was as if a tidal wave of fire was marching forever along the equator of this star, in vain pursuit of the searing apparition in its sky. That pinpoint of incandescence must be a white dwarf, one of those strange, fierce little stars, no larger than the Earth, yet containing a million times its mass. Such ill-matched stellar couples were not uncommon, but Moman had never dreamed that one day he would see such a pair with his own eyes. The white dwarf had transited almost half the disk of its companion. It must take only minutes to make its complete orbit, when Bowen was at last certain that he too was moving, as it was becoming rapidly brighter, and was beginning to drift against its background. It was through some small, close body, perhaps the world towards which he was traveling. It was upon him with unexpected speed, and he saw that it was not a world at all. A dully gleaming cobweb or latticework of metal, hundreds of miles in extent, grew out of nowhere until it filled the sky. Scattered across its continent-wide surface, for structures that must have been as large as cities, but which appeared to be machines. Around many of these were assembled scores of smaller objects, ranged in neat rows and columns. Bowman had passed several such groups before he realized they were fleets of spaceships. He was flying over a gigantic orbital parking lot. Because there were no familiar objects by which he could judge the scale of the scene flashing by below, it was almost impossible to estimate the size of the vessels hanging there in space. But they were certainly enormous. Some must have been miles in length. A million years ago, for nowhere could Bowman see any sign of activity. This sprawling spaceport was as dead as the moon. He knew it not only by the absence of all movement, but by such unmistakable signs as great gaps torn in the metal cobweb by the wasp-like blunderings of asteroids that must have smashed through it eons ago. This was no longer a parking lot. It was a cosmic junk heap. He had missed its builders by ages. And with that realization, Bowman felt a sudden sinking of his heart. Though he had not known what to expect, at least he had hoped to meet some intelligence from the stars. Now, it seemed, he was too late. He had been caught in an ancient automatic trap set for some unknown purpose and still operating when its makers had long since passed away. It had swept him across the galaxy and dumped him, with how many others, in this celestial Sargasso, doomed soon to die when his air was exhausted. Well, it was unreasonable to expect more. Already he had seen wonders for which many men would have sacrificed their lives. He thought of his dead companions. He had no cause for complaint. Then he saw that the derelict spaceport was still sliding past him with undiminished speed. He was sweeping over its outlying suburbs. Its ragged edge went by and no longer partly eclipsed the stars. In a few more minutes, it had fallen behind. His fate did not lie here, but far ahead, in the huge crimson sun, towards which the spaceport was now unmistakably falling. Now there was only the red sun, filling the sky from side to side. He was so close that its surface was no longer frozen into immobility by sheer scale. There were luminous nodules moving to and fro, cyclones of ascending and descending gas,
prominence is slowly rocketing towards the heavens. Slowly, they must be rising at a million miles an hour for their movement to be visible to his eye. Which he was descending. The immensities of Saturn and Jupiter had defeated him during Discovery's flyby in that solar system, now unknown mega miles away. But everything he saw here was 100 times larger still. He could do nothing but accept the images that were flooding into his mind without attempting to interpret them. As that sea of fire expanded beneath him, Bowman should have known fear, but curiously enough, he now felt only a mild apprehension. It was not that his mind was benumbed with wonders. Logic told him that he must surely be under the protection of some controlling and almost omnipotent intelligence. He was now so close to the red sun that he would have been burned up in a moment if its radiation had not been held at bay by some invisible screen. And during his voyage, he had been subject to accelerations that should have crushed him instantly, yet he had felt nothing. If so much trouble had been taken to preserve him, there was still cause for hope. The space pod was now moving along a shallow arc, almost parallel to the surface of a star, but slowly descending towards it. And now, for the first time, Bowman became aware of sounds. There was a faint, continuous roar, broken from time to time by crackles like tearing paper or distant lightning. This could be only the feeblest echo of an unimaginable cacophony. The atmosphere surrounding him must be racked by concussions that would tear any material object to atoms. Yet he was protected from this shattering tumult as effectively as from the heat. Though ridges of flame, thousands of miles high, were rising and slowly collapsing around him, he was completely insulated from all this violence. The energies of the star raved past him as if they were in another universe. The pod moved sedately through their mist, unbuffeted and unscorched. Bowman's eyes, no longer hopelessly confused by the strangeness and grandeur of the scene, began to pick out details which must have been there before, but which he had not yet perceived. The surface of this star was no formless chaos. There was a pattern here, as in everything that nature created. He noticed first the little whirlpools of gas, hardly no larger than Africa or Asia, that wandered over the surface of the star. Sometimes he could look directly down into one of them to see darker, cooler regions far below. Curiously enough, there appeared to be no sunspots. Perhaps they were a disease peculiar to the star that shone on Earth. And there were occasional clouds, like wisps of smoke blown before a gale. Perhaps they were indeed smoke, but this sun was so cold that real fire could exist here. Chemical compounds could be born and could live for a few seconds before they were again ripped apart by the fierce nuclear violence that surrounded them. The horizon was growing brighter, its color changing from gloomy red to yellow to blue to blistering violet. The white dwarf was coming up over the horizon, dragging its tidal wave of star stuff behind it. men had ever dreamed. Beyond the realms of sea and land and air and space lay the realms of fire, which he alone had been privileged to glimpse. It was too much to expect that he would also understand. The pillar of fire was marching over the edge of the sun like a storm passing beyond the horizon. The scurrying flecks of light no longer moved across the redly glowing starscape, still thousands of miles below. Inside his space pod, protected from an environment that could annihilate him within a millisecond, David Bowman awaited whatever had been prepared. The white dwarf was sinking fast as it hurtled along its orbit. Presently it touched the horizon, set it aflame, and disappeared. A false twilight fell upon the inferno beneath, and in the sudden change of illumination, Bowman became aware that something was happening in the space around him. The world of the red sun seemed to ripple, as if you were looking at it through running water. For a moment he wondered if this was some refractive effect, perhaps caused by the passage of an unusually violent shockwave through the tortured atmosphere in which he was immersed. The light was fading. It seemed that a second twilight was about to fall. Involuntarily, Bowman looked upward and checked himself sheepishly, as he remembered that here the main source of light was not the sky, but the blazing world below. It seemed as if walls of some material, like smoked glass, were thickening around him, cutting out the red glow and obscuring the view. It became darker and darker. The faint roar of the stellar hurricanes also faded out. The space pod was floating in silence and in night. A moment later, there was the softest of bumps as it settled on some hard surface and came to rest. To rest on what? Bowman asked himself incredulously. Then light returned, and incredulity gave way to a heart-sinking despair. As he saw what lay around him, he knew that he must be mad. He was prepared, he had thought, for any wonder. The only thing he had never expected was the utterly commonplace. The space pod was resting on the polished floor of an elegant, anonymous hotel suite that might have been any large city on Earth. He was staring into a living room with a coffee table, a divan, a dozen chairs, a writing desk, various lamps, a half-full bookcase with some magazines lying on it, and even a bowl of flowers.
The Arkansas Time Traveler!
Yeah.
And that was a star-spangled washboard band with the Arkansas Time Traveler. Good night, Seekers.